And I'm not talking about me speaking up here. I'm talking about we being in Alcoholics Anonymous. There were some places that I was at, some people that I was around, and a lot of times I barely made it out. And for you folks that are out here, if you really look back in your stories and you keep your story up front as to the things that happened to you, the consequences of your drinking, it's easier to stay sober than to get sober. My training is that it's very, very, very basic. I tell my story. My grand sponsor is a woman named Liz B. And Liz B celebrates every year at Jones Beach, okay? And that's going on 2 Sundays at Jones Beach, okay? In July. One of my mentors is a gentleman named Phil P. And Phil P's story is in the big book. And I love to hear these people speak. But I want you to know that neither Liz B. or Phil P.'s story got me here. And I'm saying to you that there's no such thing as a master storyteller. The best story is your story. Please tell your story. And just before... and just before I get started telling my story, I'm going to tell you about 2 people who didn't follow those directions. There was P, and he used to be at the Hick Street Group. And Stan P would always talk about this, the steps and traditions and the slogans. And if you heard Stan P speak, he sounded like the second coming of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. But unfortunately, Stan P never talked about what was going on with Stan P. He got hit with a domestic issue. He shot his girlfriend and killed himself. Stan P. There's another gentleman named Elliot Green. And Elliot Green started the second oldest AA meeting in Harlem, the Mid-Harlem Group. Elliot Green is responsible for a lot of folks in this room being sober today. He was the person who started those alcoholism treatment programs, those state programs, Bronx State, Rockland State, Middletown State, Creedmoor, et cetera, et cetera. But Elliot Green forgot his story. He started hanging out with Mayor Beam, Governor Carey, and he started drinking. Unfortunately, Elliot Green never made it back. So please tell your story. Now, my story is like this. I grew up in a household where my father never drank. Never drank. My father never had a drink in his entire life. My father worked for the Parks Department. My father went to work every day. He went to work if it was 7 degrees below zero, if it was 99 degrees. If it was raining, if it was snowing, my father went to work. Never drank. We were the first family in my neighborhood to have a color television. And I mean a real color television. I mean the things that some of y'all had, you know, you put the plastic on the top and all that kind of stuff like that. We had a real Zenith color television, all right? My father worked so hard that when he retired from the Parks Department, he got paid for a whole year after that. And those were the old days where there's no direct deposit. My dad had to travel up to Katona Pool every 2 weeks to get his check. So that was my dad. My mother was a nurse. My mother, I'm an only child, and for the first 12 years of my life, my mother stopped working. So, and my father and my parents let me know that they loved me. My father used to call me his pride and joy. My mother took me to all kinds of museums. I was in all kinds of different classes. I was able to read before I went to school. So I can't tell you the reason that I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous because my mother was flat backing in hotels. My father had his hat on backwards and was talking out the side of his mouth. That's not what happened. Not what happened. There was love in my house. We took family trips. We took family vacations. We did things like that. So I knew what family was about. But there was this thing that had, like I said, I grew up in this time of this television, and they had these guys on TV, the courtship of Eddie's father, my 3 sons, Father Knows Best. And what I got captured by the illusion of the exterior. I saw how these guys were dressing. They wore suits and ties, and my father always wore those green Parkman uniforms. And I began to start thinking that my father. What I can tell you is that, you know, I wear a suit and a tie every day for what I do for a living. I'm just becoming the man that my father always had been. So I don't get confused with those kind of things. So we had in place, and then the time that I grew up was the time it seemed like the music was about getting high. we had the Temptations, and they had out Cloud Nine, Psychedelic Shack. And then my main man, Sly Stone, Hot Fun in the Summertime. And I, you know, I had a theme song back then. I Want to Take You Higher, right? And that's all I really wanted to do was to get high. The first time that I drank was in the Polo Ground Houses. And it was one of those grind-em-up parties. And they were playing slow records. And every time a slow record would come on, I would move or try to move, but I couldn't move. My feet were like rooted. Another record came on, I'd move. Couldn't move, was rooted. And finally, Big Smiley, Cuda, and Donald told me to come outside. We had some Rich's peach wine. I drank that wine. I came back into the party. The next record was a record called Stay in My Corner by the Dells. The alcohol transformed me. I became Michael Jackson, Nicky Barnes, and Billy D. Williams. I saw a pretty young thing. I asked her to dance. We started dancing. I could say to her all the things I always wanted to say. I've been looking at you all night long. I had fun. It was partying. I mean, it was a beautiful thing. But there's a man in the meetings that goes, man that goes to the meetings up in Harlem, his name is Coyle Fisher, and he has 44 years. And Fisher always says all along his drinking, the signposts were up along the road. And from the beginning, the signposts were up. Danger, hazard, do not enter. And I kept proceeding. I could have made AA after that first night. I want you to know that. I grabbed the behind of the knockout artist of 8th Avenue's, his sister, right? Not a smart move. I went to a store and I started cursing at the man. The man pulled out a double-barreled shotgun. I said, go ahead and kill me, you know? All those things happened the first night. And then finally, that was just the first night. Now, that was my whole drinking career now. That's the first night. And then finally, the coup de grace was, you know, in those old days, they take you up to your parents' door, they lean you up against the door, everybody ring the doorbell, everybody cut out. My father didn't drink, so he knew what alcohol smelled like, you know what I mean? And my father tuned me up. And you would think that that would be enough, but it wasn't. Because what happened the next day, I got a lot of notoriety, and everybody was talking about what I did and what I had said, and the race was on after that. Now, I just want to talk about the guys that I drank with the first time, because it's a gift and a blessing that I'm here. Big Smiley, they found him rolled up in a carpet with a needle in his arm. He had overdosed, and that was in 1970. Donald kept getting arrested in New York, and he finally had to move out to Boston. And Cuda is still chasing dreams out there. And I stand before you in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous only but for the grace of God, by God's grace and no more than that. thank you. Now, what happened with me, I was the kind of kid that you hated because I was the kind of kid, I went to school every day. I didn't miss school. And I was the kind of kid who read three chapters ahead. And I was the person who always had their hand up. Had their hand up. And I never played hooky. Because to me, it just didn't make sense to go to school and not go in. It just didn't make sense to me. But my condition of going to school, a lot of times I'd be torn up because I started drinking scubbing off in the morning. I mean, all those kind of things, and I would go to school like that. For whatever reason, school came pretty easy to me. I got a scholarship to go off to a college in North Carolina. At that time, it was ranked 7th academically in the nation. I was on this college campus, and it was like I hit the lotto. My father drove me down there. He was so proud. My parents drove me down. They were so proud. My father gave me $1,000, and that was like in the 70s, so I could have it into my account. They gave me stamps and stuff like that so I could write. And I was on this college campus, and it's like a dream come true. Maya Angelou was one of the professors down there. I took one of her classes. It was like a beautiful thing. But what happened, I started drinking down there. And down in Carolina, they drink Slitz malt liquor, the bull. And then we started having keg parties. And my grades started to start plummeting. And they said to me, listen, we need you to go to summer school. And me and my arrogance said, summer school? I'm not going to summer school. Came back to New York. I went to a CUNY school, Lehman in the Bronx. Flunked out of Lehman to the point where they told me I had to leave. They just said, you know, you're taking up space, you have to leave. My uncle had a couple of businesses, and my uncle said, listen, not everybody has to go to college. He says, what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you this business. Don't have to give me any money. As you make money, you pay me off. Hooked up this business, got all kinds of licenses for this business. The only thing about this business is that it was on 116th Street between 7th and Lenox Avenues, and this was in the 70s, and if anybody knows anything about 116th Street, it was the drug capital of the United States of America. I thought that I had the only legitimate business on 116th Street for a number of years. And what I became very friendly with were these people called shoplifters, boosters. And what they would do, they would bring materials, items to my store. And I had all kinds of cameras and televisions and stereos and all kinds of clothes. And then I got very, very, very arrogant. And I would say stuff to people like this. I make more money in a day than you make all week. To the young hustlers and the hustlers, I would say stuff to them like, my one chain weighs more than all those trinkets you got around your neck. When you talk to people like that, they take notes and they remember. My dad had been trying to warn me and say, listen, the same people you see on the way up, the same people you see on the way down. I never thought I was going to go down. I started going to places like the Rainbow Room, the Top of the Park. The waitress would stack the champagne glasses one on top of the other. She'd pour the Dom Perignon in the top glass. It would flow down like a waterfall. I was 23 years old. I was wearing diamonds and rubies. You couldn't tell me nothing. But alcohol is patient. Alcohol is patient. Some bad things happened, some bad decisions were made. I lost that business. And my life began to start changing in a very rapid way. Those bars and stuff like that I used to go to where everybody knew my name, no longer going to places like that. You know, you begin to start drinking whatever anybody else has, and you begin to start sharing it and all those kind of things like that. And I remember one time I had gotten stabbed, and I was outside of Harlem Hospital. And I had become a gopher for a panhandler. So imagine this. Me used to drink Dom Perignon with a big bag of change, was telling me, yo, go to the store and get me an Old English, and you get one for yourself. Okay? Yo, come, hurry up right back, all right? Panhandler. And one time, the panhandler finished his a little bit too quickly, and he asked me to have a sip, right? And I looked at the panhandler's mouth, and he had all this crust and stuff around his mouth. I'm not going to go any further with that story. I ended up in a psychiatric ward in Harlem Hospital in the K building because of drinking. Not because I was crazy, but because of drinking. And, you know, when you get into a psychiatric ward and they have you strapped down in the straitjacket, all my home training came back. I was strapped down. All of a sudden, I would say, I saw the nurse or doctor come by. Pardon me. May I have a word with you for a minute, please? And when people think you're crazy, they just walk right by you. You know what I mean? I want to be very clear because this is an ugly disease. When I went into a treatment program, this was my condition. I weighed 129 pounds. I had VD. I had the crabs. I had a heart murmur. Plus some dudes that beat me with bats and 2x4s. So I was pretty lumped up. I went into this hospital and... they began to start treating my conditions. And in the beginning, AA was real exciting to me, and I sat in the front. But for the grace of God, works if you work it. I was sat in the front rows, but this hospital had a gym in it, and I started exercising. And as soon as I could do 25 push-ups without stopping, AA was no longer exciting to me. I made one good decision while I was in there. I got a sponsor, a temporary sponsor, and that person took me down to, he picked me up from the hospital, and he took me down to the Living Now group. This was when Living Now was on St. Mark's Place. I went into Living Now right now, went into Living Now, and there were people that had mohawk haircuts, purple hair, combat boots, dog collars around their necks, and these were the women. So I said to myself, I said, is this what I've been reduced to be around people like this? And I spiraled out of AA again. And, you know, all kinds of things happened to me. But the key thing that happened to me, the people that I love, people who cared for me, I began to start hurting them. And that was what began to start impacting on me. My mother had been taking me all kinds of places to get me prayed on. They used to have prayer lines, you know, like people from Mississippi, Alabama, or North Carolina, they'd all get on the phone at 12 o'clock. We're going to be praying for Robert, you know what I mean? All those kind of things like that. But finally what happened, the last time that I drank was August 24th of 1984. And it wasn't the worst time. In fact, it was one of the better times. I was drinking, I was in a spot, but I said these famous last words, give me one more. And I took that one more, and some humiliation, some degradation happened, and I got kicked out of that spot. And I was walking down the Viaduct, and I saw this lady. I've done things that were not nice to people. And I was walking up onto this lady, and I was getting ready to snatch her pocketbook. And just as I was going to snatch her pocketbook, she turned, and she said, God bless you. I didn't snatch her pocketbook. I went into the garbage and I got out cans and bottles. And the only thing I could get was a nip of Miller and two little cigarettes. And I sat on a park bench and I drank that Miller and I smoked those cigarettes. And I said, what had happened to my life? How did I end up like this? 2 days later, I came to my home group, the KISS group. And a gentleman was celebrating his second anniversary. And he looked like $1 million. His mother was there, she was in the back, and she was shedding tears of joy. His daughter brought him up the cake, and just for the first time, I had a little bit of hope. I saw him 2 days later at another anniversary. I walked up on him, and I says, I was wondering if you'd like to be my sponsor. There's no profanity in the big book, so I don't curse when I'm up here, but I'm going to say this because this is what it sounded like. It sounded like he said, fuck you and go dig a treasure. So I scratched my head and I said, what did you say? And he said, sure, it would be a pleasure. And what that man allowed me to do was see the parade of life. And that same night, I met the woman who's my sponsor today, a woman named Joyce. And when I met her, I said, you've been coming to AA for how long? She said, 13 years. Oh, that's very nice. I said, well, how many times have you been out? Because I thought everybody was like me. As soon as you get some money, you go back out again. Joy said she had 13 years. Couldn't believe it. And then they took me up to the Claremont group. And they had a group anniversary. The speaker was a guy named Donald R., God bless the dead, and he was really good. And he told a story, something like mine's, that even if he had money, they wouldn't allow him to go into bars. And I identified with that. But what they had at this group anniversary, they had, oh, let me say you this. I was back in my father's house. I was back in my father's house, and my father didn't really like what I had become. So my father was kind of tight whenever I ate anything in the house. If he saw me with a plate, so hold up, where you going with all that food? Take some of that food off your plate. You ain't bringing no groceries in here. But I went to the Claremont group, and they had fried chicken, baked chicken, candied yams, collard greens, macaroni and cheese, potato salad, I mean, a whole spread. Group anniversaries, people be partying and dancing and stuff like that. Not me. I got my plate. I went in the corner. I started humming Old Time Negro Spirituals, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, free at last. And I had arrived. My time is just about up. Let me just talk to you a touch about recovery. Let me talk to you about recovery and what sobriety really is. And it's important for us really, like I say, to tell your story. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I had lost the ability to read. I couldn't read anymore. If you heard me speak, I sounded like a punch drunk boxer, duh, 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 dumb. I would go to step meetings and I would always practice on reading the longest paragraph in those step meetings. And that's how I learned how to read again. I came to a meeting and there was a gentleman named Murph and he was speaking at this meeting and he talked about coming into AA and not having a GED, getting a GED, getting a CAC, getting his bachelor's degree, getting his master's degree. I got inspired again. People talk about leave your degrees outside the room in AA. I don't believe that. We need to talk about and celebrate the successes and the triumphs of what Alcoholics Anonymous allows us to achieve. I have all those degrees today. I've worked for the United States Department of Justice as a consultant. And I'm not in law enforcement in any kind of way. But my job was to go and to train branch chiefs, borough chiefs, commissioners about how to do their jobs better. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed my mother, who was 95 years old, to see her son, 90 years old, to see her son sober for 25 years, okay? And it put years on her life. Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to right now have like a marriage that's like, it's like a Tyler Perry movie and War of the Roses. I mean, it's like one of those kind of things. I paid my daughter's tuition, college tuition. And you know, college tuition is expensive. My wife had the nerve to claim her on the taxes. But you know what? All I do is pray for her. That's all I do is pray for her. And I hope that she gets healthier. In closing, let me just talk about this. I want to say this because I don't want you to get confused about what is the gifts of sobriety versus the gift of sobriety. There's a difference between the gifts of sobriety. The gifts of sobriety is you get a car, you get a wife, you get things, all those kind of stuff like that. That's the gifts of sobriety. The gift of sobriety is totally different. The gift of sobriety is that my mother, every time I would go down south, had to show off her son to everybody in church because she was proud of what I had become. And everybody said, oh, you her son that got the house in Westchester. The gift of sobriety is that my daughter is coming out of college with no student debt. The gift of sobriety. The gift of sobriety is that when people see me in the street, a lot of times they say to me, are you a minister? Because they see something different about me, and this is how we should be carrying ourselves. And then finally, it's unconditional sobriety. Unconditional sobriety is if my daughter gets a scholarship to Yale or goes to jail, I can't drink. If the next woman I get is Serena Williams, or if my wife goes with a hobo, I can't drink. If something seriously happens to me, I can't drink under no circumstances. So people that are new, adopt the gift of unconditional sobriety. Your sobriety is here, it has to be paramount. Life is gonna change, things are gonna happen, things are gonna go up and down, but you don't drink under any circumstance. Thank you for letting me share.